My name is Edward Austin Hall. My age is 59. Today's date is April 22nd, 2021. And my partner today is Leslie Wheeler, my friend, fellow poet, and colleague in the world of weird fiction.
My name is Leslie Wheeler. My age is 53. Today's date is April 22nd, 2021. My partner today is Edward Austin Hall, and Ed is my friend and a writer of weird fiction and poetry whose work I admire tremendously.
I'm sorry, Leslie, I am getting some feedback. Could you turn down your volume a little bit? That just started. Okay, let's go through.
You want to do that again?
No, go ahead with your conversation. I'll keep an eye on you.
Okay. So, Leslie, the damnedest thing happened while I was reading Unbecoming. And I'll let you provide your own description, but my shorthand of it is this is about a woman who is entering menopause or perimenopause and begins to suspect that she has magical powers. And so, of course, there's a lot of blood involved
here.
And before this thing that happened, I was making some pasta dish and skinned one of these knuckles. And so I'm reading your book and I'm on page 38 and I realized that this little divot where there's no skin on my finger is fused to the page of your book. And I'm like, I'm literally like trying to pull it away. It's like your book is a leech, right?
It's a vampire book. That's
it's
great.
A vampire book. And okay, that would be disturbing enough. However, the word I've noticed, I was reading when I noticed that I was fused to your book was, let me make sure I made a note here, rusty collar. I'm reading the word rusty collar when I realize it. So I pull my finger away. This is right at the bottom of page 38, which ends a closed quote, which ends with a period. And I left a tiny little mark right under the period. So I literally contributed period blood to your novel. Man,
that is a wonderful line.
If I were just imagining things, and this happens a lot in your book, I should point out, the very next thing at the top of page 39, at the end of the period, and the first words on page 39. Okay, Leslie, is there something I need to know?
I think that uncanny things happen all the time, and you know that too. So, yeah, the book was responding to you, Ed.
That sounds like the glibest, slipperiest rejoinder from an enchantress I've ever heard. But okay, I'm not gonna press you on it. We can move on. But I expect me to circle back to this because I.
All right,
I'm
ready.
Leslie, really, seriously. So, I'm going to give you the opportunity to summarize your novel as you see fit, since I kind of jumped in and did that from my perspective. But please tell us about Unbecoming and a little bit about how you came to write it and how long it took, that kind of thing, please.
Right. So, I started writing this book in 2015. I was at the time 47 and approaching menopause. My children were leaving for college. I was feeling that this was not a good phase of life to be entering, that I was basically on the verge of death, which is ridiculous. But what I needed to do was find a way to understand the transition as to reframe it as a power empowering transition. And I looked into myth, I thought about stories. There's actually, until very recently, there's been very little to read about menopause. So I didn't find enough out there. So I decided to try to write the book I needed to read. And I wasn't at all sure I could do it. I'm a poet and I've written several books of poetry, but I wasn't sure I had the stamina for a novel. I wrote the first draft in 7 weeks. I just sat down and I went into a kind of dream or fugue and just wrote almost around the clock. And then, of course, I spent years revising it because I did not know what I was doing. But the first experience of writing it was really kind of magical. And even though I did not myself gain uncanny powers with menopause, I did gain the power to write a novel, which seems kind of strange and unlikely to me.
I'm sorry, I need to jump in. There is some feedback on your line, Leslie. That seems to be echoing. Maybe we can go back to the headset and just see how that is.
Okay.
I am sorry.
No, that's all right.
Great. Would you just count backwards from 10 once you're all set?
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Okay. I think that's better. I'll keep monitoring. I'm sorry.
I think I was hearing that noise too.
Okay.
A little bit of reverb, sort of. So, thank you, Daniel.
Do we need to repeat that Q&A? No.
So, and thank you, Leslie. That's it's good. Still feels slippery to me. There are times in your book where it feels as if your book is not just recounting the story you described, but it's also the characters will, at one point, your protagonist says, "What kind of story am I in?" And that's, she teaches English. Have I got that right?
Yes, she does. She's an English professor.
She also teaches English. And so, that's not an unusual comment for an English teacher to make about her own life, but coming in your novel, it has a different feel to me, right? I feel like there were times I felt like I could see you literally casting spells on the page.
Well, I really appreciate that. And as I said, writing the novel had a spell-like quality to me. But I also think, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm attracted to weird fiction or fantasy fiction, is because I don't know what the boundaries of reality are. I've perceived them as slippery my whole life, and life as a profoundly strange, weird thing that is full of uncanny powers and forces that I don't always understand. And certainly writing partakes of that. But I certainly think that somebody who reads and writes literature is aware too of how one source of literature's power is that sense of strange connection that you feel when you read, as if you're eavesdropping on somebody else's thoughts, and that this person made out of words suddenly comes to life for you. And it was interesting to experience that much more as a writer than I had previously, is that sense of the characters all taking on lives of their own. And I would be in the shower and they would say things in my mind and I'd get out and I knew what the next paragraph was. It just wasn't something that I felt totally in charge of.
Ed, could you turn down your volume? And if you have it, also kind of stick in a headset. I'm still getting a little bit of feedback. I'm worried it's coming in on your line.
Me?
Yes. Yes.
If you have no headset.
Can you just
can't help you there, but I can lower the volume.
Yeah, please.
On
just on your computer.
Yeah. How's that sound now?
We'll just keep trying.
Okay. So, characters talking to you in the shower. I'm not unfamiliar with that phenomenon, although mine came in a rather different context. Another time I'll tell you that story. It's not a cheery story. But that happened with my first novel, but, wow. It was genuinely scary. So let me pivot here and ask, how many languages do you speak or read or are you versed in? And have you ever lived abroad, Leslie?
I studied abroad in England when I was an undergraduate, and I had a Fulbright to New Zealand in 2011. Those were the only times that I've lived out of the country for an extended period. I studied French and Latin in school. I went back to France for a vacation a few years ago and discovered almost none of it is left. I can point to a croissant and ask for one, but that's about it.
So I bring this up because early in the book, the figure of Hanako,
yes,
manifests, the right. the toilet stall ghost of Japanese, I gather, modern Japanese folklore.
Yes, that's my sense too. Yeah,
toilet stalls not being particularly ancient. And the reason that I ask about this is there's something, let me look it up, because, again, back to page 39. So Hanako is invoked, Hanako-san. And then in the very next paragraph, I remembered I should check on feet. I needed to thank her for the flowers. Do you know the roots of the name Hanako?
No.
Hana actually means flower in Japanese. It's like the only Japanese word that I know off the top of my head, because I was creating a Japanese character years ago and I thought about naming the character Hana. That character remains unnamed to this day, but H-A-N-A is flower in Japanese.
So you're finding more uncanny coincidences in the book, things I didn't know.
This is what I'm talking about. So
that's wonderful.
Similarly, do you know Royal Tyler's Book of Folklore, Japanese Tales?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Is that who the character Royal is named for by chance?
No, I didn't even think of that connection.
I hadn't thought of it either. And then I was like, I have to ask her, oh, wait a minute. I wonder if she named it. Because I thought Leslie wouldn't do that. That's probably just a coincidence, right? I tend to give writers crap when they do that, right? Like just look to the bookshelf and name somebody. Notoriously, Larry Niven in the first draft of a novel, he changed it later, but he named the character Octavia Butler.
That's not a good choice.
So, I'm like, nah, she wouldn't do that. It's just too easy. So, where'd you study English?
I studied, I earned an undergraduate degree at Rutgers and a graduate degree at Princeton.
And when did you start writing poetry versus when did you start publishing poetry?
I started writing poetry actually when I was a kid. And I went to a Catholic all-girls high school, and I had a very strict English teacher who was a nun, Sister Ignatius, who demanded that I enter a literary prize, a poetry prize for area students, and I won first prize. I decided, oh, maybe I'm not so bad at this. And then in college, you know, I was at a big state school, and poetry classes were smaller than fiction classes, and I loved to be able to participate. And so I love sound. I'm a very sound-oriented writer, so poetry is very appealing for that reason. But I also think that there were those bits of luck and circumstance that sent me down that path. I was always a really avid fiction reader, too. I was somebody who read all through every spare minute growing up. But poetry kind of became the focus, and partly because of those accidents and partly because of just that love for its qualities, its sound qualities.
Do you have a favorite work of fiction by chance?
Well, I can't say that I do, but I can say that the book that's probably shaped my imagination most is Jane Eyre. That's a novel. My mother is British, and so she, as when I was a child, she just gave me all the novels she read growing up, and so she handed me Jane Eyre when I was 9, and I read it first then when I was the age that Jane Eyre was in that red room scene at the beginning, and I read it very much as a sort of adventure story of the suffering of a young woman who then triumphs, and just kept rereading it as I got older and my sense of the stakes and the concerns of the novel kept changing. So I would say that that novel, more than anything else, has inflected my sense of what a story can do. You mentioned Octavia Butler. I'm a huge fan of hers as well, and probably 25 million other fiction writers I could name if I could think of them.
What were your parents' names, please, before I forget?
Yeah, Patricia and William.
Mm-hmm. What was your mother's maiden name?
Kane, C-A-I-N, like mm-hmm. Kane and Abel, yep.
I was going to say, yeah. And who in material that I used to, when I wrote for White Wolf, Kane was the original vampire. Kane sired by the vampires in White Wolf's World of Darkness for their Vampire the Masquerade game. So
right.
I guess your book is a vampire. After all, legit. So, where did you grow up?
So my mother emigrated to the States in 1962, met my father on a blind date, and they married in 65, and they lived in Long Island at the time. So I grew up partly there and partly in New Jersey, moved there when I was 9 or 10, Jane Eyre reading age.
Mm-hmm. Do you have siblings?
Yes, so I'm the eldest, and I have a sister a few years younger and a brother who's almost 10 years younger than I am.
Mm, that's my situation.
I'm
also the caboose, 10 years behind the sibling closest to me, and not to the eldest. She's 14 years my senior.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, you're supposed to be the creative one as the youngest child. I'm just supposed to be bossy.
And? Are you?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I work very hard at not being a control freak, but that is my disposition.
So now when you say control freak, is that, are you casting any runes to do that? I'm hoping I'm going to catch you, right? Like, there's totally... You know, what's the line? There's an exchange that I think the characters Fee and Cynthia,
right,
that they have, where I think Cynthia says, "Are all women casting spells? Are all women working magic?" And what's the response, please?
The smart ones,
only the smart ones. Damn.
Yeah, I think, you know, that we do have influences that we're not always completely consciously in charge of, or that, and certainly there are a million terrible things that we could fix about the world if we had those magic powers, right? Like, too bad we don't.
Yeah.
Going back to what I said before about the weirdness of the world and my sense of uncanniness permeating it, I can't influence reality to the extent of any of those characters in the book, and I don't know any recipes for magic spells, but I do think it's important to discover what kind of power you have and use it for the betterment of the world.
There's another writer I want to ask if you're familiar with. There's something that Fee says at one point. She talks about that she prefers to travel light. And I wondered if you were purposely referencing the Naomi Mitchison novel by that title.
No, I wasn't.
No.
What's it called?
Travel Light.
No. No, I have not.
I want to say it's a fantasy novel, 20th century fantasy novel about kind of magic waning from the world. It's only like half a magical, a fantasy novel.
Right.
The back half of it's very much, very mundane, extraordinarily mundane, because again, it's about what John Clute refers to as thinning, that basically trickles away.
Right.
And I kind of stopped enjoying it halfway through, but I'm glad I read it. You will recall, I know you'll recall this, my novel has a quote from her brother, from Naomi Mitchison's brother, Haldane. Can't remember his initials. JBS. JBS Haldane is Naomi Mitchison's brother. And I think they were both, I didn't realize this the last time I name checked him, but I think they were both eugenicists. So.
Oh no.
But that's my version. The quote from Haldane is my version of what you talk about, that the world is genuinely uncanny, right? The world, the universe is not only queer than we suppose, but queer than we can suppose.
Oh, that's an epigraph to your book, isn't it?
It is. That's and I'm with you. I've never seen a ghost, but at this stage, and I had to tell this story to a friend recently who accused me of craziness. And also I think when I emailed you about preparing for this, I said I don't want to give you too many details lest you think me insane, right? Because again, I had this thing with your book, with the leechcraft, you know, of your book, like, oh, let's get a blood sample from this guy. But I did have this episode a couple of years back where I was having this stabbing pain in the side of my neck, which could have just been neuralgia. But when you start having stabbing pains in the side of your neck, and you're a student of voodoo, you start to wonder if somebody's like poking an effigy of you somewhere else in the world.
Right.
And as it happened, there was somebody that could have been really pissed off at me who happened to be in a part of the world where they might have come by this. And this happened only when I was asleep, like in the middle of the night. And I mean, just excruciating pain. And so it happened over a couple of nights. And I think two or three nights in, not necessarily successive nights, I feel something grasp one of the thumbs on one of my hands. Like literally, I feel another hand pinch my thumb and drag it between my index and middle fingers. And I wake up with my hand in that position. Which is really creepy because the thumb, as you probably know, the thumb between those two fingers, that's a mystical gesture in a lot of cultures. It's also an obscene one in, I think, many more. But it's Malocchio in one of my ancestral cultures. In Italy, it's literally it's what you do to ward off the evil eye. That's what you use to ward off the evil eye.
You know, ghosts are not always things that we see. We perceive them by other means. And the way I described hearing characters' voices, particularly the voice of the most uncanny character in the novel, Fee, she talked to me all the time. I hear voices occasionally, especially when I'm waking up or falling asleep. I'll hear a funny little message or maybe just somebody calling my name. And I don't know what that is, but another weird thing that's happened to me is I live in a town. When I first moved there, I used to hear a train whistle in the middle of the night. And I used to take walks in the area looking for where the train tracks are. Like, what am I hearing? And could never find it. And eventually I learned that I do live around the block from where the train used to run. And the rails were pulled up in the 40s when the train service stopped. But there had been a train right there just around the block for years and years, it was decades. So, yeah, that was uncanny. Like, what did I know that I didn't know that
I know? Don't you have a poem about that in the state she's in?
Yes, there is. So, okay. Yeah.
I thought I remembered that. Right. Great collection of poems, by the way.
Thank you.
If you're hearing this and you like poetry, you should invest in that book, The State She's In.
Thank you. I was writing it more or less at the same time I was writing the novel Unbecoming. So there is definitely this crossing back and forth between the thinking about the territory of Virginia where I live and thinking about the territory of middle age.
Well, I'd like to talk about both of those things. Let's talk about Virginia first. We are now, days beyond the... I've heard a lot of people use the phrase, I feel like I can breathe again, in the aftermath of the conviction of Derek Chauvin. Now we can literally now say the murder of George Floyd. In both The State She's In, which is a multivalent title, and in Unbecoming, there's a lot of stuff about race. And how you, as a white woman, me as a black man and a reader of your work, you know, I appreciated and found very thoughtful. And so talk about that some. Talk about the role of race and living in the South and living in the former.
Yes, I live in
Confederacy. Have I got that right?
So it's not the former capital of the Confederacy, but it's a really important site for it because I live in Lexington, Virginia. I teach at a place that is still very unfortunately named Washington and Lee University. Robert E. Lee is buried on campus and is a namesake. He was president of the school for a while, and Stonewall Jackson is also buried a few blocks from my house. So, it was a very strange place to move from New Jersey in 1994. I had no idea what I was getting into, but it was profoundly weird to see Confederate reenactors marching up and down Main Street once a year and flaggers, Confederate flaggers, they call them, all over the place. And it was a distressing move. And I think for a long time, my feeling was, I am not from here. I am not complicit in this. I was looking down my nose. And especially in the lead up to the 2016 presidential election, it became clear to me that that was not a tenable position, that I was complicit, that I had to, that I was being paid a salary by an institution that had been bequeathed a large group of enslaved people and then sold them down the river to improve its operating budget, and that I needed to own up to that. And I think everything I started writing from then on, I was both trying to come to terms with the place I lived in a natural way, in what the ground and the land feels like and what it means to live on it as gently as I can. But also coming to terms with a really brutal history, not only of the enslavement and Jim Crow, but also of the genocide of Native American populations that once used that area as a hunting ground. And it seems really dishonest to me to write about place in the South as a lot of white writers do, without acknowledging the complexity of race and what it means. It's intimidating, it's hard. I know that as a white woman, I'm bound to be stupid about so many things that I have not been forced to think about in my life, but you do your research and you try, like you acknowledge the complexity of the world just as you acknowledge the strangeness of the world in a slightly supernatural way. You acknowledge the strangeness, the political strangeness, and the awfulness of what has enabled the way that you live now. You just have to. It's just wrong not to.
And talk more briefly about also what this felt like, given that you were also menopausal or premenopausal as all this is happening. What right. that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was a sense, you know, I had hit middle age. I couldn't deny it anymore, and that meant that I had then at that point lived more than half my life in the South without thinking of myself as a Southerner, and also was just depressed. Like, you know, so I am, this is not where I expected to be. I did not expect to spend most of my life in the small town South next to the ghost of Stonewall Jackson. Like this was not what I had wanted for myself. And there's a poem in the poetry collection called Turning 50 in the Confederacy. And that's what I felt that I was facing, you know? That I don't think those are exactly the concerns or worries of the character in the novel, but that sense of being stuck and being awash in powers that you don't want to acknowledge that you have, like those powers for Sin, the character in the book, are also the powers to improve the racism or mitigate it at her, the mm-hmm. institution for which she works. You know, she has not been acknowledging those powers either. And part of how she needs to change over the course of the novel is to recognize that if she refuses to own up to the privilege and the power that she has, she's doing more harm. So those things did feel deeply linked to me.
Thank you. That's all good to hear. And honestly, deeply reassuring.
Can you explain why reassuring?
On one level, it's great, particularly I think in the realms of weird fiction. I mean, I expect this in the precincts of literary fiction. I think I was at the point of watching a fight break out on the State of Black Science Fiction website, which I helped administer on Facebook. Okay. I posted a picture of Samuel Delaney, and this is actually a StoryCorps story, Daniel. I posted a picture of Lauren McAlpin and Samuel Delaney, so a white a man that Chip Delaney identified as a white gay man, and then Chip Delaney is a famous science fiction writer, African American from a long line of Delaneys, born in Harlem, grew up in Harlem, lived in New York for many, many years, now lives in Philadelphia, coincidentally. But Chip is very light-skinned, and now he looks like Santa Claus now.
Yes.
And so there's a picture of this guy who looks alarmingly like Woody Harrelson and this other large man who looks like Santa Claus. And I post it on this now private group for Black science fiction writing, Afrofuturism, all that stuff. And one of the other Black members wanted to ask me, like, why are you putting this here? And I thought, because my comment was in this StoryCorps interview, because the StoryCorps interview that Chip had been looking for years had never heard it. And I found it in the archive and I linked him to it. And this member of the group wanted to know why I had put it there. And I thought, I'm going to presume he knows that Chip is Black. Because what I wrote was, Chip Delaney reveals the biggest open secret about New York City in the StoryCorps interview.
Right.
And so I explained that remark and what it was. This was Chip was talking about in the 60s when he spent somebody essentially dared him to spend 24 hours at a stretch in Grand Central Station, which he did. He was actually there for 28 hours and realized, remember, in the 1960s, not like homelessness is now in the United States. It was largely invisible.
Wow.
And so he realized that there were people who lived in Grand Central Station.
Right.
And so I watched a lot of people basically dogpile this person who asked this question, like, don't you know Samuel Delaney is Black? And this kind of went on for a little while. It was starting to get out of hand. So I said, first of all, I said, y'all need to modulate your tone.
Yes.
And the commenter said, you know, no, I knew what his race was. I said, and I took that comment as sincere. And I presumed it to be about the New York part of it. And so I explained the New York part of it. And I never addressed Chip's race at all, but that's kind of my habit, right? You've read my novel, you know that like the omniscient narrator in my book never identifies the characters racially.
Right.
You don't have that luxury. And so for you to be for me, there's a certain amount of courage that comes with any white person who chooses to wrestle with the issue of race in the United States on the page. And thank you for that.
Thank you. Although I feel like my courage is nothing compared to the courage of people who are facing up to the daily experience of violence in the U.S. that's based on race. So, I mean, for heaven's sake, least I can do is.
I agree with you. But there's a second part to my comment, and that is, you know, I'm sure there are people who will be unhappy with me saying this, but on the page, and I know this, I've seen this happen in literary salons I've run, everybody gets racial stuff wrong in the United States. Everybody is capable of it. And it's not that Black people are not immune to doing that.
Sure.
And I'm sure that I will be, there will be people who will, I fully expect eventually somebody will come at me for my handling of race, which is not strictly about Black and white, I should say, in my novel.
Right.
And in some cases, the race of the characters is mysterious.
Right. We don't know everything about our characters, right?
Yeah. I mean, I actually do know the race of the characters.
But,
you know, I'm playing those cards close to the vest.
Yes.
So that gets revealed, but only when the characters talk about it. And it's, right, my novel is much more compressed than yours. About how long does Unbecoming take to unfold? Is it?
It's about 70,000 words, so it's still fairly short.
I mean, in terms of fictional time, about...
Oh, school year. That school felt year. Natural,
I was gonna say,
right?
I thought it was about a year. So,
yeah.
The old series 24 comes to mind when I think about my book, right? Like, it's right. A really compressed amount of time. It may unfold in as little as, like, 3 days.
Right.
But I haven't really timed it out. There's a trip, and I don't need to know how long that trip takes. I just know it takes some. There's some day night stuff that happens.
Right. But,
I think we are very close to time at this stage. Are we? Is there anything that I have not asked you that you'd like to just say really quickly, Leslie, about the book, about anything?
Right. I guess what I would like potential readers to know is that I really did my best to write a novel that's deeply absorbing, that moves fast, and that moves in an empowering direction that certainly helps people who are in a position similar to mine to see that that power can flow back into your life and be used for your own good and the good of other people. And I really wanted to write a book that would make the world just a notch better, and I hope that it's a pleasure to read. I'm trying to make a spell that is pleasant to be in.
Well, I can say that that spell was cast impeccably.
Thank you.
As you already know, it is far and away the best 2020. I didn't read many novels from 2020, but it was way, way better than any other one that I read and the one that I published.
No, Dread Isle is magnificent. And I can't thank you enough for saying that, because this is, I think it was a pretty good year for books. So.
Well, I will beg to differ with you. It was leagues beyond what I did. They're both first novels, and it's an extraordinary accomplishment. My hat's off to you.
Thank you.
And I won't accept anything else on that front. So, Leslie, thank you for everything that you do, that you've done. Keep up the good work, and thank you so much for making time to talk with me today.
Oh, thank you so much. It has been a pleasure to be here.
Leslie, would you just talk to Ed a bit about the difference between writing poetry and writing a novel? And mostly, I think what I'm talking about is poetry is really talked about as being so audio, oratory, right? You speak it, right? It's poetry is meant to be spoken.
Right.
But the novel, especially when you're writing, a lot of folks say when you're editing, speak it aloud. So I'm wondering, like, did you find it was more of a connection than you initially thought, or are they just two different animals?
I found them to be deeply different animals. I found that writing a novel, I thought I knew how to write good sentences until I started to practice fiction. To me, the main difference is time, that in poetry, you're creating maybe a single moment or a very short narrative and lingering in it and endlessly trying to expand it. And that's why poems are sort of meditative pleasure to read, right? You're lingering in that moment with the writer. Writing a novel, it needs to move. You need to get the extraneous details out. You need to pare away the adjectives and adverbs. You need to make the prose tight so that you're leaping from moment to moment in a way that there's enough detail for a reader to make those leaps with you, but not to distract anybody or bog them down. Just enough detail to create the world so that you can keep everybody moving through it with suspense. So for me, really, really different processes.